Hey everybody, Andy here. A little bit different of an intro this week. I've actually been working on a way to try and help introduce the game to younger players, to kids that might be interested in Magic, and saw a great opportunity with this latest set to create a little crossover media for both kids that are trying to learn their barnyard animals and also kids that maybe might be interested in Magic. So I put together a little song, and I know it's kind of weird, but I'm just going to ask people to share this with kids in their life, maybe your own kids, maybe you have nieces and nephews or friends' kids that might be interested in Magic. All right, here we go. Oh, Caustic Bronco's a horse. Caustic Bronco's a horse. Well, look at it dance. Well, look at it go. Well, look at it dance like a horse. Oh, Caustic Bronco's a horse. Caustic Bronco's a horse. Look at it dance and I look at it go. And I look at it dance like a horse. Oh, Caustic Bronco's a horse. Caustic Bronco's a horse. Look at it dance and I look at it go. And I look at it dance like a horse. Oh, Caustic Bronco's a horse. Caustic Bronco's a horse. Look at it dance and I look at it go. And I look at it dance like a horse. Oh, Caustic Bronco's a horse. Caustic Bronco's a horse. Look at it dance and I look at it go. And I look at it dance like a horse. Oh, Caustic Bronco's a horse. Caustic Bronco's a horse. Look at it dance and I look at it go. And I look at it dance like a horse. Oh, Caustic Bronco's a horse. Caustic Bronco's a horse. Look at it dance and I look at it go. And I look at it dance like a horse. Oh, Caustic Bronco's a horse. Look at it dance like a horse. All right, ready to do this thing?
Yes.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy. I am here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony, doing a set review, kicking and screaming Maddox.
We're here. I'm so excited.
Don't pretend to be excited. Look, let's talk about this a little bit up top.
Okay, okay.
I want people to know at least how I feel.
Okay, how do you feel?
Which is that I don't ever want us to be in a position with this show or anything we do for Lucky Paper where we're like doing a thing that we don't want to do. This enterprise is not, it's for nothing if not fun.
We're doing this for our own enjoyment, not for any external motivations or needs, so I totally agree with you.
Yeah, so you expressed when I brought up the fact that we should probably record the Outlaws at Thunder Junction initial set review, our personal cube editions, you expressed what I would describe as some profound existential angst about doing such a thing. And you were like, I guess I'll read the mechanics and find something to say.
Uh-huh.
And I'm saying, no, don't do that.
Okay.
Let's talk about what we want to talk about. I have some thoughts on the set. Most of them actually don't revolve around mechanics or my own Bun Magic Cube editions, which we'll get to in a second. Let's just talk about what interests us about the set or what doesn't interest us about the set and why. Because I'd much rather listen to somebody speak truthfully and honestly about something that they care about, even if it's not what I expect for an hour, than listen to somebody do what they think people want to hear as a set review, even if they don't want to do it.
But I did it now. I read all the mechanics. I read all the cards. I did the work.
Well.
And you know what? I think that where I've kind of landed on it is, no thanks.
Okay, well, we'll expand on that in a little bit. First, at the top of the show, let's get out a couple of items of bookkeeping. First, Anthony, I want to take an opportunity to just make people aware of all the wide variety of cube events that are being put on out in the world right now
that people
should be aware of that they can go to. Washington Cube Champs happened a few weeks ago, a month ago, by the time this episode comes out, thereabouts, a month and a half ago. I'm not sure when. But that was the first cube event of the year, as far as I know. And then Cali Cube Champs is coming up again. That happened last year, organized by Joe out in the Bay Area. That's going to be happening again. People should definitely check that out. I'm going to put links to all this stuff in the show notes. It's way easier to put links there than to like read stuff on air. But definitely check out Cali Cube Champs if you're in the area and you want to check it out. We have some insider knowledge that there's an event that's going to be happening in Pittsburgh in July, so keep your eyes peeled for that. The next Cube event is actually the Uber Cube organized event down in North Carolina, and that one's actually Saturday, April 27th, so the last Saturday in April. If you're in the area of North Carolina, you should check that one out. That one seems to be a lot of fun. And then, on the day this podcast is being released, some friends are announcing Boston Cube Party, which is going to be happening in Boston, and that's going to be June 22nd and 23rd in Cambridge, which is, you know, very similar to Boston, but basically Cambridge. Details for that are going to be at bostoncubeparty.com, but suffice it to say, there are a ton of awesome cube events happening, and nothing makes me happier than seeing all these awesome cube events that are going down. There's a couple, too, I'm not even bothering to mention, like our friend Noah is running a cube dungeon event just in his own house in the Midwest that I believe is sold out by now. I guess was the Ice Cube this year, or that was the end of last year? The Ice Cube might have been for earlier this year. It's hard to keep track of all the Cube events that are going on because there are so many happening, and I honestly love to see it. I would love to see even more of these events happening in the future, and just know that anyone, you know, anywhere in the world, ideally, that wants to play Cube in some kind of organized fashion or meet more people that are passionate about the format can find them and do it. So we're going to put a big rundown of all these upcoming Cube events in the show notes of this episode.
Yeah, and it's cool to sort of see how the community has kind of coalesced around a process for running these events. I mean, these are all independent things that are not part of one, they're not part of one body organizing them, but they're kind of developing a similar pattern of, I think most of these are 64-player events where there's like a nice tournament structure with a bunch of cubes, and it's cool to see, you know, everybody sort of learning lessons from each other and figuring out how to independently run these events.
Yeah, there is a Discord of Cube event organizers, so if you're interested in organizing one of your own, DM Anthony or I, we can get you hooked up with that group. And yeah, I think people are slowly starting to coalesce on what is going to be a really sustainable and reasonable way to run an event like this, which will make it even easier for people to want to do it in the future because they'll have all the lessons learned from everybody else that has done it in the past. So we predicted a Cube renaissance this time last year when we did our panel at SCGCon Philly, and I think we are living in it right now.
Here it is. What a time to be alive.
What a time to be cubing. Look, Anthony, you've already killed 4 minutes of the episode that you don't want to talk about. Also, this episode is going to be the first episode where we're talking about Outlaws at Thunder Junction. I say the first because there definitely will be at least a second, whether Anthony wants it to be or not, because we're going to be talking about the results of our community survey that we are currently running right now. So the survey is up. You can go on our website and click on it in the banner or check the link in the show notes. And you have an opportunity, basically, for each cube you own to go through the set. A nice visual spoiler, a beautiful page Anthony made where you can click the cards you're testing, rate them on a scale of 1 to 10, and then we share all that data with the community so that people that are coming back to sort of curating their cube after taking a couple years off have a nice sort of democratically ranked list of cards that are most interesting for most cube designers, which has proven to be very, very practically useful for a lot of people in the past, so...
Yeah, we've been doing these for a while. I think all the way back in Throne of Eldraine was the first one.
That was the first one, yeah, with like 35 respondents or something. So,
which is
come a long way.
Something to go on. But it's been cool as, you know, every once in a while somebody will pop into a Discord or whatever and be like, hey, I've been out of the game for a while. Like, what's new that I should look at? And it's really great to, you know, it's taken a long time to sort of build up this resource, but now we have it and can point to it and say, like, here's what people have been interested in from past sets.
Yeah, so go check out that survey on the site. I do also want to mention in passing, we did run a survey for the Fallout supplemental product and got very few responses. I think we need to be mentioned on the show, so we partially have ourselves to blame for that. But it's suffice it to say, the interest in that set is not as high for the average Magic product among most cube designers for a lot of reasons. And we made the decision that we are just not going to cover everything moving forward. There are so many products now. A lot of them are these supplemental products that are not going to have interest from most of the members of the community. So we're definitely going to cover all major sets moving forward. Prior to this, we had been covering pretty much every release. We had put every commander deck up there. Anything that had new cards had a survey and then had a corresponding article. And it's just not worth our time to run a survey that no one's going to respond to and for Parker to write an article that no one's going to read with data that is not that useful because the responses were kind of incidental anyway. So you did it, Wizards. Not everything's for everybody, and we are not covering every set anymore, so...
Yeah, I think we might still put up the data from that survey, just because people still took the time to submit that and add some nice comments as well.
I think Parker actually already wrote a little stub of an article, so...
Okay, so that'll be up there, but...
Whatever he wrote,
we'll
put up.
Maybe not necessarily everything going forward.
He was like, I don't know what to say in this article. I was like, say, here are the results. Signed, Parker. That's a small, you know, administrative note that we're just not going to cover everything anymore, so only the stuff that we deem that the community is interested in enough to be worth discussing, which I think will definitely be every core set and, you know, major expansion moving forward, and probably, you know, select supplemental products, right? Like, there was clearly a bunch of interest in the Lord of the Rings product, so, like, that for sure we were going to cover some of the sets that have more cards, or I don't know, we'll figure it out as we go, but no hard rules. Vibes only. Let's get into Outlaws of Thunder Junction, Anthony, and before we talk about anything mechanically, I want to talk about our just initial impressions of the set, because you, as you said, you've summarized your response as no thanks, and I was wondering if you could speak on that a little bit.
So when they announced that there was going to be a cowboy set or western set, I forget exactly how they announced it, I knew that this was just not going to be my style. It's just like aesthetically not my vibe. But I was really surprised when they actually started, you know, previewing some of the illustrations and, you know, giving a little bit more information about the set. the degree to which it was not for me. And I've been sort of like struggling with like, why is this the case? Like, I love Magic, been playing this game for so long. What's like, what's really so off-putting about this? And if I'm honest with myself, it's maybe I've been in a little bit of denial that this is something that is part of a broader sort of change in the game that's been happening for a long, long time. Honestly, since before we started with the game. So much of it has to do with the fact that just these sets that are just these worlds of hats where we enter some space and everything is just kind of this mono unified biome of one texture is just really aesthetically not very engaging to me. So, you know, if we go back and look at all the way back at, you know, Theros, where we're just taking, here's the we go into a portal and here's, or, you know, Planeswalk at that point, here's the Greek mythology world, or here's the, I don't know, maybe the Inventor's Fair is a little bit more of an interesting, nuanced, creative scene, but still like chunks of that are kind of cut from some other mythology. And then we go to Norse mythology world, and then we go to gangster world, and gangster world really is just like, what are we doing here?
That one was definitely not for me.
And now we open the next portal and it's cowboys. Everybody's got a cowboy hat. It just feels so thin and bland and kind of cut whole cloth from this existing thing. There's no like creative enthusiasm behind it or integrity, or there's just like nothing here for me.
I can see where you're coming from for sure. Just to tease out the distinction here, like, how do you put a plane like Kamigawa in comparison to these other ones you've mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed set by set. I mean, Kamigawa is obviously influenced by external things. Like, it still is. You can make art that references other things and ties into other aspects of culture, and that can be a great work of art. And Kamigawa, even the recent one, I thought had a, you know, expressive narrative that was compelling about the sort of tension between history and the mystical and technology. And I have trouble saying technology and progress in the same sentence these days. That's a personal issue I'm working on. But, you know, there's like an interesting tension between these different aspects of the culture there that they, I think, were expressing something. Whereas this is just like regurgitated meme of a meme of a meme. It's like it's got all the class of Wild Wild West with the sophistication of Paul Blart Mall Cop.
So it's not that you think they couldn't have done a Wild West set that would have appealed to you. It's just that they didn't. They just put cowboy hats on everything as far as you can tell.
It was going to be an uphill battle if you were going to make a Wild Wild West set that was going to appeal to me.
So there's something fundamentally about the culture of the American West that is more uninteresting to you than feudal Japan.
Sure. I mean, maybe if it was actually more of an homage to real history and real struggles, that could be appealing to me, but it's definitely based on, it feels like it's based on not any of that and just based on a cartoon.
Well, this is my core issue with it aesthetically, which I know we're going to talk about this a lot with Parker when we have him on for this set review, because it's clear this is also stuck in his craw, but I did not have an immediate visceral reaction when they announced Wild Wild West set. I was like, okay, sure. We'll see what they do with it. And I agree with you that I think some of the implementations of top-down planes that are based on pre-existing ideas or history, some of them are successful and some of them aren't. I don't think it's just that this approach is good or bad at world-building in this context. I think it's that how they approach it can really affect how it ends up feeling. And for me, the apparent complete absence of any resemblance of like a native population in the set about the American West is like a huge miss in terms of just like understanding what the Wild West is about, like what it is. Like, it's not just a place where people wear hats and there are cactuses. Like, there's a lot to it that needs to be unpacked, and that has to do fundamentally with the tension between this colonizing force and this native population. And they seem to have essentially completely ignored that. And I took to Twitter to ask about this because I was curious, like, has anybody from Wizards of the Coast actually said why there are no native peoples in this plane at all, even though it's based on this history in which this is like a key element of the narrative? And Brody, who is at CardsInHand0 on Twitter, pointed out that actually they did contract with Navajo cultural consultants to design a special race of people or ethnicity of people in the plane called the Ateen, who are meant to be a nomadic people that I guess are somehow a, like, call out to this part of the history. And Annie Flash is the main character that is one of these people. There's a couple others in the set. And if you look at the, like, art of these cards. There definitely are subtle like references to what appear to be Navajo cultural influences, but they also still have cowboy hats on. And so it's kind of like, I don't know, like it's clear there was some influence there. And I asked Brody like where I could find out more about this to like, you know, cite your sources. Where did you actually see this? And it's literally like 30 seconds of a panel where they were previewing the set. They said, oh yeah, and by the way, we designed these people with Navajo cultural consultants. End of story. And to be clear, I don't necessarily think there is like a ethical or like moral compulsion to give a like comprehensive telling of the history in every context, right? Like, I think there's a lot of stories that take place in the Wild West, and you can choose to tell some of them if you want and other ones if you don't want. But if you're always choosing to tell one story and never another kind of story, you should be circumspect about why that is. But for me, the biggest thing here is just that because they didn't address what to me is the core conflict of the setting of a Wild West, this set just falls completely flat.
The core conflict is a train heist, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, this set just falls completely flat because there is clearly no underlying, like, deep-running ideological conflict in the set. It's like, yeah, we are playing on the tropes of Westerns. And so, yeah, it's just magic, but with cowboy hats and train heists and bank robbers and whatever. And I will admit that, like, I'm not a fan of Westerns. The genre does not appeal to me a whole bunch a priori. But there is something uniquely interesting about the setting, right? And I think it's about, again, this tension between colonizers and native peoples. It's about this like rugged individualism that I think is at the core of like the American story, or at least the story that Americans tell themselves, right? This idea that people just set out kind of on their own into the wild unknown, and for a long time there were only tiny settlements sort of spread across this vast area, and there were no major hubs, and it was like you just could commit a crime and leave town and never be held accountable for it because there's no overarching society or government that can hold you accountable. Like all of those ideas and this sort of like tension between selfish individuals who are just in this world to better themselves and people that are trying to build a new society and people that already have a society in that place that is being displaced, that is an interesting story to tell. And I think they just chose not to tell it. And I imagine that they probably chose not to tell it because they were worried of...
It'd be a really hard story to tell well.
Yeah.
Right? And to tell respectfully.
I think it would be. And this is where we run into, like, you know, all these conversations we've been having over the past few episodes about, you know, how much is magic art or not. If you want your game to be art, this is what it should do, right? It should try to tell the hard stories and tackle right. The hard concepts, right? If you want your game to be Lego, where they have the Wild Western set, then that's what you got. This is the Lego set of Wild West. This is not a, like... And I'm sure, and again, I don't want to like minimize any of the creative work that went into the world building because, you know, once these high level decisions were made, obviously tons of people spent a ton of time working on the style guide and the world building and all that stuff. So it's not that like there's nothing here, but it's that fundamentally this is flawed to me as an approach. And I think you can feel it in pretty much every card. Like I don't feel a attraction to these cards the same way that I do to a plane that I think is much better resolved and has a more clear ideological thrust.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important that I don't think I'm necessarily saying this sucks. I'm saying this is really not for me, and that is an important distinction because
I'll say
they
it
are
sucks.
Okay. They're designing magic in a way to accomplish certain goals, which is honestly to sell a lot of product, and their goal is not to make a brilliant, unified, deep, compelling work of art.
No, I mean, I think it is. I think a lot of people at Wizards of the Coast would tell you that it's what they want the game to be, and sure. I think some prior planes are. And
yeah, I mean, to go to something specific that Mark Rosewater talked about when he talked about the set Dominaria, when they revisit Dominaria in, what was this, like 2019 or something?
Yeah, 2019, 2018, something like that.
He was talking about how difficult it was to approach that set from a lot of different aspects because they were dealing with this world that was complex and had a lot of history to it, and it was very difficult to come up with a single unified short description, a hook to get people, to get the players interested in the game, but honestly also to get the higher-ups in the company to sign off on it and say that, yes, this is a set we can go back to. And to me, that was just really kind of disheartening because I'm like, this is all upside. This is all depth and like history that you can draw on, and honestly, the log line of high fantasy, but you dig down 6 feet below and there's all this wreckage of this high-tech civilization and this high-tech conflict. That's a super rich, compelling world to me that is like actually original, and you know, a lot of creative work went into it. And the fact that they have moved away from that and moved towards things that can be summarized in a single line and are things that people can point to and say, cowboy hat, I recognize that, I Know What to Expect Next, is just like, it makes something that's much more approachable and digestible, but it doesn't make something that draws me personally into the game and doesn't make me excited about it.
Yeah, and that's why I'll say that, like, you can say that it's just a matter of personal preference, but I think there's a fundamental difference in approach here that is making a, like, less deep and a less long-term, meaningful, artistic gesture, right?
Right. I mean, I think another thing that it took me a while to notice felt actually very specifically different about this set is, it's not just, here's a setting, there are people with cowboy hats here. They've also chosen to take all these other characters that we've known, that we've seen in other cards, that we've seen from other planes, and dress them up in cowboy hats and cowboy boots too. It's not like, you know, the Gatewatch going to Amonkhet and being like, whoa, something weird's going on here, and we're characters that are still playing the role of...
It's like the holodeck.
This
is the holodeck set.
Yeah, it's like they've just taken this, you know, Fortnite skin of put everybody in cowboy hats, and like, it feels... Like, they just, there's no, like, continuity in, like, making these characters struggle and express themselves in this different environment. They're just like, yeah, everybody in this environment is immediately just part of it, and it just feels like a skin.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think the set is, and from a big picture, top-down, flavor, vibes perspective, a big miss for me, too. And for me, it's largely about this decision to just... because I guess it seems like it will be hard to do right, just completely ignore or erase native populations from the entire story, which, again, like, I think some people listening to this might be like, oh, Andy's on some woke shit. And, like, I do think it is a problem.
Get on your woke shit.
I do think it is a problem from that perspective, but, like, at a lower level, it's also just a problem from storytelling. Like, you just removed the good guy, and we're like, now it's all villains, so I don't... And to be clear, I was thinking about sets where I think they've tackled somewhat similar ideas fairly successfully. And, you know, someone on Twitter mentioned that, like, you know, they kind of tackled the idea of, like, slave labor on Amonkhet in, like, an okay-ish interesting way. Like, at least it was present and addressed. And for me, the one that really sticks out is I thought the original Ixalan sets, not Lost Caverns, but the original sets from 2018 or 2017 or whatever it was at this point, I thought those were really interesting depictions of colonialism, right? They are basically about, like, colonial forces coming to the New World, and they depicted the colonial forces as vampires because they are just moving through the world, sucking resources out of it, and they were clearly the bad guys, which makes a lot of sense from, a historically informed perspective. And there, they did present what seemed like a pretty compelling representation of, like, not literally these are Native American people, but, like, here is what people that live in congress with nature and are connected to the natural world, like, in a fictionalized world, might actually be like, right? And I thought the result of that was actually pretty good. Like, I'm sure there are plenty of criticisms we made about it. I haven't, like, looked for them. I'm sure they exist. But broadly speaking, it was like, yeah, you told the story of colonialism, and you did it in, like, a pretty compelling way. And I actually was kind of into the world building there. I really liked the original Ixalan world building.
The colonizers are literal vampires.
They're literal vampires, and they are, like, they're coming to this world, and they are, like, meeting the forces of, like, nature, right, that are, like, pushing back against them, and the peoples that live in congress with it, right? I thought it was pretty well done, all things considered, right? Like, again, there's a certain bar you have for a card game that is not only for children, but it's partially for children, and, you know, other kinds of art, but I thought they did a pretty good job with that, and here it seems like they just chose to not even try.
Something else I was struggling with was something I definitely appreciate about all creative works is that you can have an opportunity for a little bit of levity and not take it too seriously. Like, humor is valuable in whatever kind of, however serious a thing you're trying to do. And so I'm looking at this set that honestly has a lot of levity into it and trying to figure out, like, why does this feel different? Why am I not wanting to celebrate that? And it took me a while to realize that the answer is very simple, is that it's not funny. Holy Cow is not funny.
Wow.
Lone Shark is not that funny.
If Mark and Rosewater was a listener, he's signing off right now.
I'm sorry, but, like, Holy Cow is just so, it's too on the nose. You know, I didn't say that Magic jumped the shark when they made a literal Sharknado, but Holy Cow is maybe it for me.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, the natural progression of the things about the game we've been talking about, interwoven through the show. Again, we strive to focus on the things that we're excited about around Magic, because I don't think it's fun to listen to people complain every week. And frankly, a lot of magic content ends up being people complaining about the latest thing.
I feel bad for this episode already.
No, I don't think you should feel bad for this, because we do it sparingly, so I don't think it's like our vibe.
Do we?
I think so.
Okay, great.
There's some things we don't do sparingly. Like, we are constantly railing on complexity, for example. Like, that's a thing that we care about. But that's the thing I don't hear people complaining about in other contexts. Or at least I didn't, and maybe I'm starting to a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that and, like, the legibility issues around, like, different card versions I'm starting to see being talked about in, like, commander circles because you're trying to read board states from across the table. Like, I think complexity is actually becoming an issue for people that are not just cube designers. So that's an interesting thread maybe to follow. But for the most part, we try to talk about things that we're excited about because I think it makes the show better and it's more interesting. But I also do want to talk about the new sets when they come out, and when we're not excited about it, I'm not going to try and, you know, dress it up. Let's just be honest. Let's talk mechanics, though. I do want to go over the mechanics, because I actually love a lot of the mechanics from this set. I really, really like some of these mechanics, and I think if they had been dressed in a different holodeck skin, or better yet, part of an actual world with actual conflict and interest in it, I could be really attached to some of these cards.
Why do I like the holodeck episodes of Star Trek, but don't
like
because
the holodeck is like, it knows what it is.
It's authentic about being
the holodeck
goofy.
Is not trying to be like, it's supposed to be like the trope machine, right? That's what the holodeck is. And when this world is presented as like this beautiful thing they've spent thousands of human hours working on, and it's supposed to be telling this deep, profound story, and you're like, that's just holodeck. It falls flat. But I do like a lot of these mechanics. The first one I don't like. It's Outlaws.
We're doing great.
The first one is Outlaws.
So just an overall thought on these mechanics. I thought it was interesting that a lot of sets, you know, they try and do something big and new. You know, there's like double face cards that you can cast either side, or there's battles, a whole new card type. And pretty much all these mechanics are light diversions from existing mechanics. Like, some of these you could even just take the
probably
same
why
card.
I like them,
and I don't think that's a bad thing. Like, I think that a lot of these mechanics I read and I'm like, yeah, I understand what's gonna happen here and see sort of what the design space is. So yeah, I mean, I think that was just sort of a overall thing that stood out to me.
Yeah, anyway, the first mechanic is Outlaws, and Outlaws just boils down to a new word to describe a subset of creature types. So
batched
cards,
creature types, just like Party.
Just like Party, well, because a Party is more interesting for reasons we talked about, because it cares about having n number of different types within your party.
True.
This
is
literally just
used in slightly different ways. Yeah.
Yeah. This is literally just cards can care about Outlaws, and the creature types are Assassin, Mercenary, Pirate, Rogue, and Warlock. So any cards that have those types from the vast history of Magic are now also considered Outlaws for cards that care about Outlaws. It's a cool way to make a new thing that the set cares about that is also backwards compatible. I appreciate the attention to detail that goes into that. Like, for Commander, this is really cool because they can make new commanders that care about Outlaws, and all of these old cards are activated in this cool way because they happen to have the Assassin creature type from 1997 or whatever. Like, all that is very cool. For cube purposes, I don't want to introduce new keywords for what is almost certainly going to be no more than one or two cards I would ever consider including, right? This is just kind of additional complexity without a lot of benefit that is only going to stand to confuse people if I were to put a card like this in my cube. So just from a cube design perspective, I don't love this one. And from a broader perspective, I think it's totally fine and reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, it's there for flavor, and, you know, we get the common removal spell with set mechanic, and that's fine. I don't know that a lot of cubes are really leaning into these creature types just because of the density of them, but I mean, maybe this is a reason to start caring about them.
Yeah. Okay, I know I said I like these mechanics, and the first two are just the ones I don't love that much. The next one is committing a crime. Committing a crime is a new thing that cards can care about that basically cares about if you target an opponent, a spell or ability they control, a permanent they control, or a card in their graveyard. Basically, targeting anything that has to do with your opponent will count as committing a crime, and then there are cards that trigger when you commit a crime. There are cards that care about having committed a crime this turn. So it's another kind of almost like a batching thing, right? A way to say, take all these things that are currently one thing and make them this other trigger or this other keyword we can care about, which is kind of flavorful. I think it's interesting that, like, the attempt at making this flavorful makes a lot of sense at a high level, but then you get into the details and it's like, okay, so Wrath of God isn't committing a crime. Killing literally everything isn't a crime because it doesn't target.
It's kind of in the card name, not a crime.
Okay, sure. It is in the card name
symmetrical.
In that one. It's just interesting that a lot of things, like, I don't think the flavor ends up bearing out when you look at backwards compatibility. Like,
sure,
a lot of things that feel like they shouldn't be committing a crime actually are, and a lot of things that feel like they definitely should be committing a crime, like Diabolic, actually that would count. Diabolic either targets your opponent, so.
Yeah, actually,
there's
I was
some cards
like
each opponent sacrifices a creature. They would not count.
Right. I was actually confused by this, and I've just realized how it works. I was thinking, like, oh, so targeting cards in your opponent's hand isn't a crime, so, like, Thoughtseize isn't a crime,
but you target
the player. You don't say, like, that card over there before I can see it.
Yeah.
So, Thoughtseize is a crime.
But, you know, ultimately, it's pretty flexible. I think what I really am responding to here is not loving the flavor.
Sure.
Is that, you know, it just feels a little bit off for the reasons I mentioned, and then it also, like, the idea of crime being a thing in the Magic world is also just kind of still a little silly to me, even though it's not totally novel in this set. There has been the idea of crimes in the past, obviously on different planes, but crime not traditionally a high fantasy trope, let's put it that way. So, but this is also very backwards compatible. Obviously, there are a lot of cards that, you know, target your opponent's stuff. And one thing I will note about this mechanic and how it's implemented that I don't like, which is for backwards compatibility reasons, I assume, is that almost everything in the set, maybe everything that I saw that triggers on committing a crime, has the rider, this triggers only once a turn. And I have to imagine that is at least in part because of all of the myriad cards that would immediately go infinite with all of the triggered crime things from Magic's past. There are a bunch of old cards that just let you target stuff, right? I mean, there's a whole legacy deck around this interaction with Cephalid Illusionist where you can just target your creature over and over again. And there are other cards in Magic's history that will either very cheaply, very efficiently just let you, you know, continue to target things that you're otherwise not doing anything with. And it seems like their solution to that was just to say, hey, all these things trigger only once a turn. And obviously, in a vacuum, that is not a problem, right? Like, in theory, they can make all those triggers more powerful because they are capped at once a turn. But I do think it makes them less fun. Now there's, like, a ceiling on how much this card can do, so there's less for you to aspire to. There's less reward for building around something because you're just kind of capped at this incremental value instead of maybe exploding and having this big value all in one shot.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that because it obviously, like, is a tool to balance the power level and way that these cards work. And even though as a player, I'm like, I want to do this a lot of times. That's more fun. But in practice, the way the whole game plays out, it might be that the fact that I'm like, oh, I want to make sure I do this consistently once a turn rather than doing it all at once, like, actually might be more satisfying gameplay. And the fact that maybe it's like, okay, I'm actually splitting my attention now because I want to make sure I'm doing this once a turn, but I also want to be able to do these other things at the same time because there's, like, I can't get more value from that this turn, so let's do multiple things rather than an all-in combo. Is like, it probably is just better gameplay, even if at the moment I think I want to do this a bunch.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, if you took Young Pyromancer and made the 1-1s 2-2s, but said it only triggers once a turn, I don't know if that card is more powerful or less powerful, probably depends on context, but it's a card I'm less excited about playing with. Like, there's something cleaner about just a trigger that happens instead of having to care about, did I do that this turn or not already, which is kind of annoying.
Well, you specifically don't. I mean, that is an interesting difference between, or just the way that they've been wording effects that say, you know, this trigger is only once a turn. It feels like it would be so much of a nicer read if they just put that at the beginning and said, like, the first time you do a crime each turn would read a lot better. But they want it to be able to trigger if you've already committed a crime, then you cast your creature that cares about it, and then you do another crime, you still get the trigger, which is a little bit weird. I know sometimes people will, cast a Clarion Spirit after they cast a draw spell and then cast something else
immediately. Class a Clarion Spirit as their second spell a turn.
Right, and then it doesn't get the trigger. So it's like, it only cares about things that happen after that permanent exists, which, again, is probably, like, much better gameplay, but it does mean that the wording is less fun to read.
But that's not what I'm talking about. I just mean that, like, yes, this is just one of the many game design knobs they can turn, and in theory, it should not make the game pieces any more or less powerful or whatever. It just seems less fun to me. Like, the fun of, like, really being rewarded for your build around, really being rewarded for drafting a deck that can commit a bunch of crimes because you can play your payoff and then commit 3 or 4 crimes in one turn, that dynamic is, I think, much more rewarding than basically turning these all into more incremental value engines, of which we have many.
I mean, I think you're probably right that there would be so many cards that just let you target for free because
that's my hunch.
They're self-balanced by the fact that, like, oh, I'm targeting you to look at your hand. Like, there's no reason to do this multiple times. There's no additional value, so they can allow you to do it for free. I'm just, like, imagining there is some weird artifact that does that. And because of just sort of, like, the history of Magic, there are probably a lot of things that would be very broken.
Maybe even just stuff like, you know, Scavenging Ooze, like agreeing to commit a crime as many times as your opponent has things in their graveyard, right? Like, I don't know for sure, but I imagine this was a part of the balancing of the mechanic and implementation was saying, hey, this is a cool thing for us to care about, but thinking about all the Eternal formats, all the Commander players out there, a lot of these cards I think would be very difficult to balance if they could just trigger indefinite numbers of times. So,
yeah.
And it's, you know, it is a bummer if you have a cube that doesn't have any of that stuff, right? Like, you're essentially, these cards are getting, like, kneecapped a little bit because of the eternal context in which they exist in. Refer back to our episodes about designing for an eternal world, but that's just one thing I noticed about the mechanic, is that the mechanic on its face, I don't know the flavor, I think it's kind of interesting, I'm down to like play with it a little bit, but in implementation, the fact that almost everything I saw cares about only triggering once a turn, like, again, I would take less powerful triggers that I can trigger an unlimited number of times to like balance the card to be the exact same power level. That to me is just a more fun dynamic.
Sure. Something else that I noticed, though, is that it has had an impact on the way they designed the rest of the set around this, in that a lot of cards that normally you would see in a set just say, you know, for example, here's a creature that when it enters the battlefield, you draw a card and lose one life. That card in this set says target player draws a card and loses one life, which I assume is just because
they want
you to have the flexibility to commit crimes. And sometimes that might mean actually like helping your opponent. So I like the impact that it's had there, where more cards are targeted, which gives you potentially more interesting gameplay moments.
Yeah, I was looking through the set and saw...
At the cost of being more difficult to play on Arena, which is not our priority.
No, but I'm glad to see them printing that regardless of the additional clicks on Arena or whatever. There's one comment I saw that I really liked that is not right for any of my environments, but, you know, if I had a Pauper Cube or a Battle Box that I was maintaining still, it's just a new Phyrexian Rager, but it's a 3-1 and the card draw is targeted.
Right, exactly.
It's so sick. Like, that's just an awesome card design. Love that design so much. So... the fact that this means we got targeted card draw is awesome. So good. The next mechanic is Spree. I feel like you're not going to like this one, but I do. I'm a big fan of modal cards, and this is basically like the most modal of all modal cards. So Spree is kind of like a variation on Kicker, but the way it works is there is mana cost in the top right, as always, but on all the Spree cards, paying that mana cost in the top right doesn't get you anything. That's just the like... cost of entry for casting this spell, and then every Spree card has a menu of options that you can choose one or more additional costs to pay, and for each of those additional costs you pay, you get their corresponding effect.
Okay, so you do have to choose at least one. I can't just cast Explosive Derailment and say, red, cast spell.
Correct. You cannot just get cast spell trigger.
That's too bad. I wish you could do that.
That probably is an Arena thing. I can't imagine how many people would misclick and just cast the thing without...
I cast my thing and you do nothing.
So... this is just, you know, yeah, a very, very modal mechanic where I think I should have looked more closely, but it seems like almost all the Spree cards have three options. So you're basically getting a card that can be...
there's some variety. They all have at least two, obviously.
But for example, the ones with the three options, right? You have so many different ways you can cast this card, right? There's just for one of the each option. So that's three for option A, option B, option C. Then there's option A and B and A and C and B and C. So that's six different ways to cast it. So there's seven different ways to cast this card, basically, whether you cast every permutation of one, two, or all three modes, if it's got three modes, which I like the modality. I understand and am very sympathetic to your observation in the past that a lot of modal cards don't feel flavorful. They don't feel like they have an identity. They just feel like a menu of options. And I think this might be one of the greatest offenders in that regard of modal cards. But... from a game design perspective, for making game pieces that create the kinds of games of Magic that I like, Spree is pretty cool.
I see where you're coming from about why I might dislike this mechanic. I don't have strong feelings about the mechanic itself. Like, it's very flexible. They could make any kind of card with this mechanic that they want. But what I think is interesting is that a lot of the effects actually are linked in a way that feels more interesting than just like a menu of like you get A, B, or C.
The actual card designs, like, I think, do work in a very resonant way.
Yeah, it's like tutor up a land and then you get a creature whose size is equal to the number of lands you control. It's like, okay, that's a little bit flavorful that I'm, you know, and these kind of like fit into the same strategy that makes sense.
Bounce a creature, destroy the creature with the greatest power, right? Like, it's got cool stuff that is basically self-contained within the card that they do relate to one another.
Right, and a lot of times it's like, yeah, so the abilities just feel linked. Like, even Getaway Glamour is kind of interesting in that you exile, you blink a creature, and then you can also destroy a creature if no other creature has greater power, which is, again, kind of funny wording that it's not targeting that second one, but they want you to be able to target it if the other creature that you're blinking was the bigger one when you put the spell on the stack. So it's like, yeah, okay, this is like letting me craft this moment in a way that's more interesting than just totally unrelated effects.
Yeah. Gavin did a Good Morning Magic video about this mechanic, which I thought was really interesting. And I want to call out something he noted in that video, which is that he was talking about Kicker and comparing it to other modal mechanics like Flashback, and made the point that on Kicker cards, something that is a nuisance is that you have to, like, do work in your head to figure out the total amount of mana you're going to pay for a spell. You have to add up the mana cost in the top and the kicker cost, or if it's got multi-kicker, how many times you plan to kick it, to then look at your lands and figure out, do I have enough mana to actually cast this spell? Whereas Flashback, You just see the whole cost in one spot. You don't have to look at two parts of the card. You don't have to do any admittedly basic arithmetic. You just, there's the cost. You just pay it. And was talking about how that's a problem that they have like solved with Spree. And the solution is just this plus sign next to the mana cost at the very top right of the card, which indicates that it's never going to cost just that little amount. There's more cost you have to pay on the card. But I thought it was really interesting because the whole video, and I, Gavin, I know you listen sometimes, so, you know, no offense, but I thought it was really funny because the whole video to me...
Gavin has tuned out after part one where we bashed
Gavin
on the
is
set.
Gone. It was really funny to me because the video was a really awesome introduction to this like little problem that game designers have to think about that players probably never, ever do, and a really interesting window into the advantages of some mechanics over others. He also compared it to like Overload. Overload, for example, is a lot closer to just Kicker, but writing the full Overload cost in the rules box compared to having mana value plus kick or whatever just makes it a little bit more digestible. And to me, the Spree cards just seem like, again, the greatest offenders in this regard, right? Like, now you have to add up things from multiple different spaces of the card, and you're almost certainly going to be casting more than one mode multiple times, so you're adding up three different values. Like, his argument was that here was the problem, and we solved it with this little plus symbol, and my takeaway was, wow, that's a really good articulation of this problem, and I don't think you've solved it. I think it is just as present, if not more so, with Spree.
I think that all of those elements, both the plus symbol in
the plus
frame
is
helpful, and I think the plus symbol in the text box, to me, that all is helpful and just makes it much more clear what this is. Like, obviously, it doesn't solve the problem that I have to add two costs together, but it means that like, my brain can shortcut to the let's add stuff together rather than figuring out do I need to add stuff together.
Okay, quick. How much total mana for all modes of Final Showdown?
1, 2, 3, and 8.
3.98 seconds.
I mean, yeah, that is the amount of time it takes compared to just looking at it and saying, oh, it's 8. I just know how to read mana cost because I play Magic. So, I don't know. As a cube designer, I love those kinds of videos that Gavin makes where it gives me more insight into little parts of game design that you might not think about. I mean, everything they added is going to help address this problem, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's only better than if they didn't have the plus signs in both places. That would be worse, but I still think overall these cards are going to suffer from that kicker math nuisance. And it's just a nuisance. It's not a huge deal to me.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of I think this was an Odyssey block when they put the little tombstone on all the cards that had any kind of graveyard thing.
So good.
It's a little disappointing that they got rid of that, but it would be cool if there was a more general way to just be like, clue you in, like, hey, this is a card that has additional cost. This is a card that has graveyard interaction. And it's obviously not going to be complete because if you have a Zombify in your hand, any creature now has graveyard relevance.
But then you have the card in your hand to look at. Like, it's important that you have a thing to, like, key you in on each zone, right? Like, if you're looking at a card that has reanimation ability, you know to look at all the creatures in your graveyard.
So yeah, I mean, I guess if I had any criticism is, it would be cool if there was like a structured way to have all these hints in a more consistent visual language.
I'm sure Mark Rosewater has talked about why they stopped doing the tombstone thing or didn't do it in future sets.
And his answer was kind of wishy-washy. It was like, yeah, I don't know why we stopped doing that.
I mean, one thing I could imagine is that like a tombstone, even though every game of Magic has a graveyard called a graveyard, I think a tombstone has a very specific aesthetic vibe that is not at home in every plane, and so it makes a lot of sense in the like literally the graveyard set, but then as soon as you're doing Invasion or Apocalypse or whatever, you're just like, well, now all of a sudden the like gravestone feels out of place.
Yeah,
but yeah, I agree with you that like it'd be very cool if there was a like concise visual language that could be in predictable places that was agnostic to plane or agnostic to flavor that would tell you, hey, this thing has additional cost, hey, this thing cares about the graveyard or whatever. It's actually interesting. I have thought a lot about some of these little considerations in my starter deck project, which I haven't revised in a while, but a friend is currently playing with their partner and giving me feedback on it.
Nice.
So it's in my mind right now. And I made a choice very consciously in that deck to make the red deck be the deck that cares about additional cost to casting a spell. So in every other deck, the thing you see in the top right, with one exception, I think, is the thing you're going to pay for that spell. In the red deck, I intentionally like overloaded it, right? It's got like Thrill of Possibilities where you got to pay the mana and discard a card. It's got Bedlam Reveler where you're not actually going to pay that mana. It's got, you know, all kinds of things that care about affecting costs so that is something you have to care about all the time, right? It's like you're playing the red deck. My little descriptor is like, hey, by the way, check out the additional costs on all the cards because what's in the top right is not always going to be what matters in that deck. It is important, I think, especially when you think about, you know, the accessibility of the game from a new perspective, right? Like, very early on, when you're teaching someone to play the game, you say, you play a land a turn, then you see if you can cast anything. And the same way that a new player is going to lightning bolt your face on turn one, a new player is going to try and cast a Spree card and then be like, oh, actually, I can't, even though you told me this is how mana costs work. The next mechanic is mounts and saddle, which is a mechanic I've kind of been expecting for a while. Ever since they introduced vehicles, I was like, surely creature vehicles is going to come. There's a couple components here. Mount is a new creature type, so all of the creatures that have the saddle ability also have the mount creature type, and then there are obviously things in the set that care about the mount creature type. And then saddle is an activated ability you can activate only as a sorcery, and it basically works very similarly to crew. The saddle is always associated with a number, and you have to tap any number of creatures with total power equal to or greater than the saddle number to saddle the creature. And what that means then is the creature's stats don't change or whatever, but now it is saddled, and all of the cards that have the saddle ability also say if they are saddled, they get augmented in some way. So you can basically use your other creatures to hop on your mounts.
Yeah, sorry. I gotta hop on.
And that gives the mount some buff that's specific to that card's rules text, and they are a little better for that turn while they are saddled.
Yeah, a few details that are relevant is you can only do it as a sorcery, which means you're doing it on offensive. You're never getting a defensive buff. And I think most of them, if not all of them, trigger when they're saddled, when they're attacking, something will happen. So it is definitely a much more offensive mechanic.
Yeah, and this addresses what I think is like kind of a oddity, which is crewing at instant speed. That's a thing that can feel weird in some circumstances where your opponent goes to like, you know, bramble crush your vehicle and then you turn it into a creature and now it can't be bramble crushed
anymore.
Bramble
crush on the brain.
Got bramble crush on the brain. The fact that you can just like turn a thing into a creature at instant speed is relevant for a lot of removal in a way that doesn't feel totally, again, flavorful. Like, oh, I'm going to try and blow up your helicopter. It's like, I got in the helicopter. You can't blow it up now. It's like, it's just kind of funky. So
that makes sense to me. You try and blow up my helicopter, I'm getting right in that helicopter.
So yeah, they just committed to this being a mechanic that, like you said, purely offensive. It's going to care about attacking. The things that have saddle abilities are going to benefit from attacking, and that's what you're going to use it for. And the fact that you're obviously tapping other creatures means that you are, you know, committing to being the aggressor. So this is not a mechanic that's going to do anything when you're behind pretty much at all, but when you are ahead, it's going to let you press that advantage.
This reminds me a lot of Enlist, which lets you do something sort of similar, but just like add the power and toughness. Or is it just power from one creature to another when they're attacking? But this is just like a much more open-ended mechanic where they can, rather than just adding powers together, do anything they want with that trigger.
Yeah, and unlike Enlist, you can tap summoning sick creatures to saddle, right, which was my biggest complaint about the Enlist mechanic, was just like, oh, I have to just, I feel like I'm always waiting. I'm always waiting to do my Enlist thing. I don't get to do it when I want to. I think this is a cool mechanic. It may prove in Retail Limited to have a sort of exert-like snowballing effect where mechanics that are do nothing when you're behind and give you benefits if you're ahead can sometimes have a snowballing effect, which I don't think any cube designer is going to have to worry about unless you're piling a bunch of these into your cube. But given that it is a mechanic in the set, it's possible that that might prove to be a play pattern that people don't love in Retail Limited. Time will tell. But in terms of the individual card designs, I think they're elegant. It makes a lot of sense flavorfully. If you know vehicles, then I think this is very intuitive. And I really like this mechanic for that reason. Also, I think part of the fun of Magic is some of the silliness that comes from novel interactions between cards.
I get in my motorcycle, and then I put my motorcycle in my helicopter, and then I put the helicopter in the train.
Right, or like Emrakul gets on my anteater, right? Like, like that's just, it's just fun.
If your opponent doesn't just concede after that, then I don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, you're really flexing on him if you're using Emrakul to saddle anything. So the last new mechanic in the main set with a proper name is maybe my favorite, and it's Plot. Plot is in some ways very simple. It's an alternative cost on a card where you can, instead of casting it, you can plot it for its plot cost, which is spelled out separately in the rules text box. And a plotted spell is exiled face up and can be played on a future turn, not the same turn you plot it, at sorcery speed for no mana. So you're basically putting a spell on layaway by plotting it face up, which on its baseline just gives you, I think, really interesting sequencing opportunities. And really helps the kind of decks I love that care about, you know, getting triggers or protecting one key card or something. The fact that you can essentially put your spells matter thing on layaway and then wait till next turn, play it for free, and immediately have a bunch of spells to cast to get benefit off of it, or immediately have counterspells up to protect it. So cool. There's also additionally cards in the set that care about being plotted. So if they are cast from exile, they do slightly different things. In some of those cases, a plot cost is much more mana than the regular mana cost. So they are effectively modal spells too, because a lot of the ones that have plot do something different when they're cast from plot. So The bass line is just a really cool sequencing mechanic that I think is elegant and clean and simple, and the sort of next level is a like small take on a modal mechanic where plotted cards actually do very different things depending on the turn in which they're cast. The most common design I see here is like a card that gets some benefit from something else happening that turn, and it's way easier to get that benefit if the thing was plotted ahead of time, because you now have the rest of your mana to commit to triggering that thing or getting that benefit that that card cares about.
Right. I mean, at its core, this mechanic is really pretty simple. It's sort of like suspend whatever you want. You can take it off suspended at any time. Unlike suspend, which has this very clear value proposition of, you know, you can cast this Errant Ephemeron for 6 or whatever it costs, or just for 1 mana, you can have it a couple turns from now. So this is very clear, like, trade-off between mana and time. There isn't necessarily that trade-off here because a lot of the plot costs are the same or similar to the mana costs. And instead, there's just a whole bunch of infrastructure built around plot to, you know, cards that, like you're saying, care about if this is your second spell or if this is resolved after something else. Like, cards that just care about a lot of things happening, or cards that care about something being cost without a mana cost is like a very explicit reference to can you plot, but also allows you to key off of other things to be a little bit backwards compatible.
Yeah, I think mechanic is really cool. I said I liked a lot of the mechanics in this set. The ones we just covered, Saddle, Plot, Spree, those I think are fantastic. The other ones, you know, I got pros and cons, but really into a lot of these mechanics. So part of me is a little bummed that they're all attached to cards
from
this plane. They all have
a cowboy hat.
That all of these cards have a cowboy hat is not my favorite detail, but I will take it for some of these cards in my cubes.
Do you think Plot finally makes Balance good?
Wow. Balance good for the first time? Tune in later in Vintage. We're the only place where it's legal to see if that's true.
And Cube.
And Cube.
This is why we cube. There are a couple other little mechanics. Caring about creature power 4 or greater, I'm surprised sometimes about what they choose to actually label and call out and highlight as the headline mechanics and what things they just kind of slip into sets without really mentioning them. But there are a ton of cards that care about big creatures, which
that
is...
That did have a name in the past, right?
Ferocious, I think it was called, yeah. Somewhere in the cons block. There's also a pretty big theme of casting multiple spells a turn, which is definitely a thing that we see in lots of cubes because people love to cast a bunch of spells, and obviously that works really well with plot, but also other things happening in the set. The last thing that stands out to me is that there's a novel token, a 1/1 mercenary that you can tap to give another one of your creatures at sorcery speed +1/+0, which is, I think, kind of a cool way to make use of 1/1 tokens, which, you know, often can just be there like clogging up the board state, or, you know, if somebody has a big creature, they just don't really do anything. So giving this ability to buff another one of your creatures is kind of an interesting twist on like a go wide strategy.
You did do the work. Look at you.
I did the work. I read all of these cards.
All right, well, let's get to our personal cube additions. Here's how I want to do this.
Okay.
I don't know what you have, but I'll go through what I have first. Here's where I'm at in my cube design journey right now. I'm building the 100 Ornithopters cube, and it's all-consuming right now, and I'm barely thinking about the Bun Magic cube or anything else.
Sure.
So I looked at the cards in the preview. I started filling out my survey.
And you said, is this an Ornithopter? Is this an Ornithopter? None of these cards are Ornithopters.
So I looked through the list of cards, and there's a bunch that I think are like solid maybes in the Bun Magic cube. There are like 2.5 that I'm definitely going to play. And I'll tell you what those are now. We'll go over those, and then maybe I'll list off the bunch of maybes. But I have put very little thought into these, so I'm not going to like BS on air. I don't really know about them. First is a card that feels like it was designed to appeal to me specifically, and that's Slick Shot Showoff. 1 red for a 1/2 bird wizard with flying and haste. It has plot for also 1 red, and in this case, there's no other additional benefit from plot. It doesn't like do anything different if it's plotted, so it's just, do you want it now for 2 mana, or do you want it on a future turn for 2 mana with your mana available?
Maybe you have balance in hand.
And importantly, it says, whenever you cast a non-creature spell, Slick Shot Showoff gets +2/+0 until end of turn. This thing is cracked. It's cracked, it's a Spells Matter payoff, and it uses plot in the coolest possible way, where you can plot this on turn 2, and then turn 3, attack, and swing in for 7? You know, in the Bun Magic cube, casting 3 spells on turn 3 is not that hard to imagine, it's not that far-fetched, plus holding up counter magic to protect it. It's just so cool. Really into this card. Clearly the kind of card that is made for a player like me. The next card I think I'm into, this is my half a card that I'm interested in, is Goldvein Hydra. This is X and a green for a 0/0 Hydra. It's got Vigilance, Trample, and Haste. Enters the battlefield with X +1/+1 counters on it. And when it dies, you create a number of tapped treasure tokens equal to its power. This is kind of just like dumb, scalable beef. I really love scaling cards. I wrote a whole article years ago about why I like scalable threats in mid-range decks and aggro decks. And frankly, as the Bun Magic cube has gotten more powerful, a a lot of the scalable cards just have not held up on power level. And it's appropriate that they always be a little less powerful than something on curve. I think that's still very much true here with the Gold Vein Hydra, but this is your new like mythic green creature with just a little bit of keyword soup and tons of beef. So I think this is good enough to try testing. I like it as a payoff for generating a bunch of mana without having to put 7 or 8 mana cards in your deck. So that's my half a card. I think I'm interested in it. We'll see how it goes.
I can't find the cowboy hat in this one.
So you should like it more then, right?
Yeah.
And the last card is from the big score, which is other cards that are also in the set but not in the set, and they're all more powerful. I don't understand it. I don't know about it. I don't want to talk about
it. Since you brought this up, we always look at the mechanics article that Wizards puts out that describes, you know, what's going on in the set. In this article, they just start out with, like, let's explain a bunch of acronyms, and I'm like, Jesus, this is what I have to do at work. Don't make me parse all these acronyms.
Yeah, just don't do it. I didn't do it either. Emma Partlow did a great tweet where she explained all of the details of all of these different set symbols and the cards and where you can get them. I don't care about any of that. I want to talk about it. I want to talk about Harvester of Misery. 3BB for a 5/4 with Menace. When it enters the battlefield, other creatures get -2/-2 till end of turn. Already kind of cool, a like big evasive creature with an infest stapled to it would be a really cool card for control decks to turn the corner and start beating down. And then it has this additional gravy for 1 and a black. You can discard it and give target creature -2/-2 until end of turn. This is really appealing to me because it speaks to a specific kind of card I've wanted for a while, which is control payoffs for blue black. It's not in blue and black, but I think this is a card that will scream control, and in Bun Magic Cube, you really want to be in blue if you're playing control at all. The fact that this is a cheap removal spell if you need it, relatively cheap, you know, not cheap, but relatively cheap. It is uncounterable because you're just discarding the thing, which is kind of nice. Then it's also just a finisher that can turn the corner in a big game when you get to 5 mana. I think it's really cool. I'm very excited about it for the Bun Magic Cube. All right, rapid fire. The other cards that I like have a quarter of an eye on, though like I said, I'm not thinking really hard about this set right now. Aven Interrupter, Archmage's Newt, Giralf the Fleshrite, Caustic Bronco, Geesa the Hellraiser, Tiny Bones the Pickpocket, Reckless Lackey, which is a common, that's a whole other conversation for another time, Outcaster Trailblazer, Lost Gite, Slick Sequence, Malcolm the Eyes, Railway Brawler, and Sword of Wealth and Power, which I actually could talk about, but I'm not going to because we're running out of time. A lot of cards that I think are pretty interesting in this set, because like I said, I like it a lot mechanically. So the mechanics in this set I think are really cool. Flavor, not for me for all the reasons we talked about, but that is what I got for this set for the Bun Magic Cube.
Cool. So I did find... Oh, man. Look at this little cactus guy.
Do you not think the cactus is cute? I feel like you would like the cactus guy.
Okay, so the first card... I'm not confident I'm going to put these cards into my cube, but...
History proves you probably won't.
It's been a while since I've made substantial updates. Like, honestly, this is the great thing about Cube, is that you can engage with the game and new sets on your own terms. And
So don't fake it. Yeah. Don't come on the show and say you're going to put cards in your
great.
Cube.
So these are cards that I noticed that would be appropriate for my Cube.
These are cards that Bizarro Anthony in a parallel universe might put in the regular Cube.
Trained Eryx. This is 1 and a white for a 3/1 cat beast mount. Whenever it attacks while saddled, it gains first strike until end of turn and scry 1, and it's got saddle for 2. I really appreciate this card because it's first strike is a really relevant ability in this low powered environment that is my main cube, and just having this like option to have a 2 mana 3/1, which is fine, and when your board state starts getting a little mucky, you can give it first strike, also get a little card selection from that scry. It just adds up to a thing that I think would play well in that environment. I'm a little hesitant about Saddle 2, just being like the only thing that is a mount is, you know, it's weird. But
it's not weird, it's fine.
Okay, great, it's fine.
I think the mechanic is totally at home and evergreen. Like, I don't think you would have balked at putting just one vehicle in your cube. How many vehicles are in your cube? Like, 3?
Yeah, something like that.
Not that
Maybe
many.
2. Next up, Demonic Ruckus. This is an aura for 1 and a red. Enchanted creature has +1/+1, menace, and trample. And when it is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, draw a card. It's also got plot for 1 red. There's maybe a little too much going on here, but I like these things that kind of play in that rancor space, but don't have the sort of repeated gameplay patterns of it.
I was hoping you would call these out, because there's a couple of these in the set, these auras that draw cards.
Is there a full cycle of them?
Or I didn't...
There's at least a green one as well.
There's at least a red and a green one. I didn't see others, but...
So, I mean, this is not a totally unique card. There are plenty of things that sort of play in a similar space, but it also just plays into a lot of the themes of the cube, and I think if we put it in there, it'll play just fine. The last thing I'll call out, and this card I'm skeptical of, but I feel like is worth maybe talking about, is Bristly Bill, Spine Sower.
Ooh,
this is
a powerful one.
One and a green for a 2/2 with landfall whenever land enters the battlefield under your control. Put a 1/1 counter on target creature. It also has an activated ability for 5 mana, 3 green green. Double the number of 1/1 counters on each creature you control. I've tried to have a little bit of a landfall theme in this cube, and honestly, just a lot of the individual cards don't work great, but this is obviously a pretty powerful payoff for doing landfall stuff. Maybe too powerful. Bigger knock on it is I'm not into these cactus people.
I'm a little surprised. I really thought the cactus people...
Yeah, I should
people,
be the target audience. Like, make plants and
like
magic.
When they're looking at their demographics in R&D, uh-huh. They've got a picture of me on the pushed spells matter payoff right. threat column, and they've got a picture of you on cute
with
little
like
plant
squirrels
guy
squirrels and plants. I just don't like the aesthetics of them.
So that's it for our main cubes?
That's all I got.
That's it for our main cubes, but like I said, I don't have that much for the Bun Magic Cube, but I'm thinking a lot about 100 Ornithopters right now and putting this together in paper. I have 5 cards that I'm considering for 100 Ornithopters from this cube, which okay. I think is a lot. I don't have a good sense of moving forward how many new cards that cube
how
is going to get.
How often are they
going
to reprint Ornithopter? Based on history, pretty frequently.
Man, someone on Twitter pointed out that I didn't do this. I already ordered 100 Mirrodin Ornithopters because mm-hmm. it's the best canvas for alteration. Shoutouts to Bones for pointing that out to me. But someone else on Twitter pointed out that there are like 288 unique Ornithopters that have been printed in cardboard. If you take into consideration languages and foil and non-foil.
Oh,
so okay. I could have had 100 completely unique Ornithopters. And especially the idea of having different language ones is like so cool to me in hindsight because you obviously don't care about any of the text on the card. Like mm-hmm. it's so obvious what it does. You don't have to care about the language.
If you can't read it, read the other one that's in the pack.
Right, exactly. But I didn't do that. I got the other ones. And
yeah, I did not.
It's a different direction
about,
I could have gone.
I didn't think about languages. You know that when we first talked about this, I went to see how many printings there were. And there's 28, excluding like the serialized stuff, which I don't know how you want to count that. Plus, there are hundreds of dollars and unavailable. But
yeah, other people have also pointed out, hey, get 100 of the serialized ones. Yeah, cool idea. Yeah. Not going to happen. So look, here are the 5 cards I'm excited about for 100 Ornithopters. For those that, I guess we didn't give the instructions to our cubes. Look, this episode, if this is your first episode, hello.
Sorry.
Welcome to Lucky Paper. The Bun Magic Cube is an Eternal Cube. The regular cube is a lower Power Masters set level cube. Check out other episodes. But 100 Ornithopters is a cube where the only creature that can ever be in play is the card Ornithopter, and there are exactly 100 of them. No creature lands, no vehicles, no other ways to make a non-Ornithopter creature. Also, all the win conditions have to do fairly directly with Ornithopters. The biggest stretches are things like Aetherflux Reservoir, but you are for sure getting your storm count up by casting Ornithopters or something like
that. And if you're not, you're breaking the rules and you're going straight to jail.
If you're not, you're going to get some cards cut from the cube, I'll tell you that much. You're not going to jail, but those cards are. Anyway, in order of least to most excited about, the first card is Lost Gite. This is an interesting one, also maybe for other contexts. I'm not sure what to make of this so far, but this is a callback to Umezawa's Gite. 1 generic mana for legendary artifact equipment. Whenever a equipped creature deals combat damage, put a single charge counter on Lost Gite, and you can remove a charge counter to either untap target land, make it so target creature can't block this turn, or put a +1/+1 counter on the equipped creature, and it has equip 1. I'm going to avoid talking about
this. This is really funny because it triggers on damage, which means you need to make your Ornithopter bigger some other way first.
Yes, which is one of the bigger costs of this card, but it does trigger on 2 themes that are present in this cube, one of which is +1/+1 counters. I've got Hardened Scales and the other Hardened Scales, the like green Ozolith and a bunch of things, but +1/+1 counters on creatures. So the fact that it's an equipment that cares about +1/+1 counters. Actually, I lied. It cares about 3 things because it's also an equipment and there's also equipment tutor packages, Sigarda's Aid, Forge Anew, stuff like that. You're obviously not getting a huge benefit off of getting the equip 1 for free here, but nevertheless, there are things that care about equipment. So the fact that it's a type that matters is real. There's also a number of lands that tap for lots of mana in this cube and a few things to do with a huge amount of mana. And so being able to untap your Gaia's Cradle, your Tolarian Academy to make a boatload of mana is very cool. Also a fair few tech lands. Maybe you have enough mana where you can untap your Gavinny Township and put 2+1/+1 counters and everything. So it kind of touches pretty much everything the cube cares about. So I don't think it's good enough, but it's on my radar.
I actually like the tension of you might not want to use all the counters to make your Ornithopter bigger. Like, you might want to leave at least 1 counter there so that if your Ornithopter dies, you can still put a +1/+1 counter on a new Ornithopter to get more counters.
Yes, because you can leave the counter on the equipment. Then right. Move it. You do have to... The activated ability is only putting a +1/+1 counter on the equipped creature, but you can obviously let the thing die, re-equip it, and then, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you don't have to do, you basically do it right before damage, right? If you wanted to, you would never put a +1/+1 counter in at any other time otherwise. I mean, a response and removal spell or something.
Yeah, but even if you just, like, have two Ornithopters, one of them has no counters on it, and one of them has the sword, you might want to, like, yeah, just not... You might want to be reserved and not deal as much damage to your opponent as possible in exchange for having some protection in the future to be able to still put +1/+1 counters.
The next card, which I'm also a little skeptical about, but I think has more legs, is Trash the Town. This is a spree combat trick. So reading this cost aloud is, I think, one of the things that's going to really emphasize how this is not super intuitive.
It costs a green and two or one or one.
The mana symbol in the top right is a green mana. You always got to pay a green mana to do anything. It has three spree costs. The first is two generic to put +2/+1 counters on target creature. Then one generic to give target creature trample to end of turn. Then one generic to say, until end of turn, target creature gains, whenever this creature deals combat damage to a player, draw two cards. This one could also maybe do a thing in the regular cube for what it's worth.
I saw this as well. I'll write that down.
We'll come back to that later. It doesn't matter. For this cube, there is a combat tricks deck, and I think the combat tricks deck hangs its entire hat on the Conspiracy Echoing Boon. I don't love conspiracies in 1v1 zero-sum magic. I think they are often way more powerful than they have any right to be because they give you access to a thing every single game. This is not a card I thought I was going to include. A bunch of people have suggested Muzio's Preparations for this cube, which just says, name a card, and whenever that card comes into play, put a +1/+1 counter on it. So, obviously, you can name Ornithopter in this cube. All your Ornithopters can go with +1/+1 counter, or more if you have Hardened Scales going on. I don't like that card at all because it just seems like a pretty high pick for any deck. Doesn't matter. I mean, every deck cares about Ornithopters, excluding maybe the extremely all-in combo decks that are just basically using their Ornithopters as spellcast triggers or artifact ETB triggers. Every deck's going to want +1/+1 counters on their Ornithopters, and it just seems like too free.
Yeah, I think all the conspiracies are going to be really hard to pass if you were to try them.
Well, the one that I am including is Echoing Boon, and it just says you name a card, and whenever you target a card of that name with a instant or sorcery, you can copy that instant or sorcery and target something new with it, which I think is enough of a committal build around that it won't be totally broken, and it takes a bunch of cards which I wanted to be viable but didn't think were into viability, I think. Like a card like Teemer Battle Rage or a card like... Even Berserk, I don't think was actually good enough. Again, all your creatures have zero power, so doubling their power, you have to be doing other stuff, right? But I think it basically takes a bunch of combat tricks and makes them very playable by doubling all of them all the time. And that is the context in which Trash the Town is very cool, because for one and a green, you can draw four cards if you have two creatures that are about to damage your opponent, which is very powerful. Very quick clarification here. I didn't say that Echoing Boon only copies the spell if it targets a creature you control, but that is the case, so you can't, like, copy your removal spell because your opponent also has a bunch of cards named Ornithopter. Well, you could copy your removal spell, but only if you're removing your own thing, so it doesn't make a lot of sense. Actually, weirdly, you can choose new targets for the copy of the spell that doesn't have to be a target you control, so you could, like, remove your own Ornithopter and then copy it and remove your opponent's as well, which I don't see making sense, except in rare circumstances with something like Twisted Image. The point is, you have to target your own stuff in order to get the copies, and then I just say you needed two creatures to draw four cards with Trash the Town. You don't, because you don't have to choose a new copy for it, so you can just get two copies of Trash the Town, so it has two triggers. When it deals damage, you draw two cards twice. Seems good. In addition to caring about the +1/+1 counter theme that is present in the cube, and also, Trample I think is really going to matter in a lot of contexts in this cube, because pretty much every creature, no matter what, is always going to have more toughness than power. There are a few ways to buff just power, but for the most part, blocking is going to be good, right? Your opponent's going to have decent blocks with their Ornithopters on your Ornithopters, and so being able to make a giant one that then can't be chump block and give it trample, I think, is very relevant. So I think Trash the Town is actually really good for this cube if I stick with Echoing Boon.
Is Berserk not just, like, a very good removal spell here?
I mean, if you're willing to take the damage from the thing.
But you just cast this on turn two when your opponent hasn't suited up their Ornithopter yet.
If they attack with it, then yeah.
Target creature. It doesn't target an attacking creature. Target creature gains trample.
Yeah, it is a one mana removal spell.
Oh, no, if it attacked this turn. I can read this card.
Yeah, it can be a removal spell, but the way that it's worded, which is clunky with modern Oracle text, is you do have to take the hit from it first. So
yeah.
If you're willing to give something more power and trample to end of turn, then yeah, you can get beat down by it. As I'm talking through Trash the Town, I think it's actually even better than I thought. I think it's probably a shoe-in if I keep Echoing Boon, and probably only not going to see play if I cut Echoing Boon. Next up is Pitiless Carnage. a very cool plot card, in my opinion. This is 3 and a black for a sorcery. Sacrifice any number of permanents you control, then draw that many cards. And it has plot for 1 black-black. The card Reprocess is an old card that I love. It's 2 black-black for a sorcery that basically has the same text. It might be written a little differently. It might make you sacrifice as part of the casting cost, which is obviously a huge blowout in the face of a counterspell. But it's got super sick art. Reprocess is very cool. This is just a much better Reprocess.
You're making me look at old art, and I'm like, this is so cool.
It's so much cooler. Pitiless Carnage is just a much better version of Reprocess mechanically. And the fact that you can plot this to then be able to use all the cards you just drew is going to be quite powerful. This will not be among the premium card draw engines in the Ornithopter Cube, but it'll be one of the better ones, I think, because a lot of the decks are going to basically rely on churning through a bunch of creatures to then draw a bunch of cards to then reanimate all those creatures or turn them all to your hand to then like get these engines going. And so I think it'll be quite good there. Next up, Pest Control, a sorcery for 1 white-black, destroy all non-land permanents with mana value 1 or less.
That will kill a lot of Ornithopters.
It's one of many 1 or 2 mana board wipes in the cube. This one also has cycling, which I really like, especially in this context. The fact that you can play it when you're behind, you can just, you know, pop it if you want, or if you're ahead, you can just cycle it away and keep your Ornithopters around. Maybe that makes it a little bit too free to include, and you get to just free roll the board wipe.
Yeah, this seems real good.
I don't know if it's real good yet. I mean, again, this cube has Meltdown in it. It has Declaration in Stone currently, which is just exile all of your opponent's Ornithopters and none of yours. I don't know if this is too good yet. Playtesting is going to have to be done, but it seems like an obvious test given that it is a 2-mana board wipe with cycling. That's the value of playing the 100 Ornithopters cube, is that you get to have cards like this.
Enjoy, as a treat.
And finally, the card I think I'm most excited about is maybe unexpected. It's Requisition Raid. This is another spree card. It's white, so you got to pay at least 1 white to get your foot in the door. Then it has 3 modes, all of which cost 1 generic mana. And the modes are Destroy Target Artifact, Destroy Target Enchantment, and put a +1/+1 counter on each creature target player controls. I think this is quietly very pushed, because I looked at all the cards that put a +1/+1 counter on all creatures you control, and we had Basri Solidarity at 2 mana, which this is a pure upgrade over, because you also get these other 2 modes, and it's a big upgrade, especially in this context. Then you have something like Collective Effort, which is similar, it has an escalate cost of tapping untapped creatures instead of paying more mana, but I think this is just better than both of those options. And the +1/+1 counter deck, which is a thing, is going to benefit from going wide and really turning their hardened scales and similar effects into big boosts on power and toughness, and being able to have a card that is proactive for that deck and also a great answer to everything in the environment that matters. And then answer still being at sorcery speed for the reasons we talked about in our first episode about 100 Ornithopters, where I don't want to just punish the like Voltron equipment and like combat trick decks completely by having every deck able to free roll a bunch of instant speed creature removal. The fact that it's sorcery is actually a benefit for me too from this perspective as a cube design consideration.
Yeah, this card seems really pushed. I mean, 4 mana, destroy 2 things and get a bunch of counters. Like, that's just so much value. And the fact that the different modes are also useful in very different board states means that you're just going to get a lot of utility out of this.
I think a lot of times in this cube, it's going to be
in this cube all, especially,
it's
like,
going to be all
destroy a target creature and get a bunch of counters.
Destroy a creature, destroy an enchantment, and get a bunch of counters is going to be pretty common. So, yeah, it's the one I'm most excited about, even more than the other 4 we just talked about. Anyway, the relative time spent on each of these cubes is a reflection of how much time they are occupying in my mind currently. Like you said, this is the benefit of cube. I can come back to the Bun Magic Cube whenever my desire is reignited.
Or you can just say it's perfect. Doesn't need any change.
I could be that one Riptide Lab user that finished their cube, signed off, and walked away forever. The absolute legend.
Smart. Should we talk about the Turbo Cube really briefly?
If you did the work, yeah.
I've done the work. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to delete Tomb Trawler. I think I'm not into it. Mage Bane Lizard. We should talk about the Turbo Cube.
You should at least say what this one does.
Totally normal cube, except for the fact that all spells and activated abilities cost 2 generic mana less. So it's just like everybody's doing crazy combos all the time. But we can counter that a little bit with Mage Bane Lizard, which is 1 and a red for a 1/4 lizard. Whenever a player casts a non-creature spell, Mage Bane Lizard deals damage to that player equal to the number of non-creature spells they've cast this turn. This is a cool little hate lizard that's going to stop some of those combos, which feels reasonable here.
I'm excited to test it. I think this card is going to dramatically underperform people's expectations. it feels like you're always casting a lot of spells in the Turbo Cube, and then you go back and look at it,
and you're like,
actually,
I actually cycled six times.
You're actually doing a lot of cycling, or you're like, you know, yeah, you're casting a couple eggs and drawing two or three cards, but all the cards you're drawing and actions you're taking feel like you're casting a bunch of spells when it's actually just a few. So I'm excited about it. I think it's going to have the harsh mentor effect of looking like it's going to be cracked and then be fine.
Yeah, it's not insane. Unlike Giralf, the Fleshrite, this is 2 and a blue for a 2/3 human warlock. Whenever you cast a spell during your turn, other than your first spell that turn, create a 2/2 blue and black zombie rogue creature token. Is that enough?
No.
It keeps going. Whenever a zombie enters the battlefield under your control, put a 1/1 counter on it for each other zombie that entered the battlefield under your control this turn. So, zombie factorial.
Yeah, it's just like zombie tokens plus
Cathar's Crusade.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this card's nuts. I mean, at this point, we almost have like too many. Like, we got Chrome Host Siege Shark.
Nope, not too many.
And just other cards that just, whenever you, Monastery Mentor, just spam out a bunch of tokens, but I guess we're doing it.
I'm excited about it.
It'll be fun to go off with this card for sure. That's it.
That's it. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this extra long episode of Lucky Paper Radio. You can have it as a treat. Because we complained a little bit, we'll make the episode longer for you, just so you get it all.
Yeah. Hopefully you just skipped that complaint and had a normal length episode.
Yeah, we do have the timestamps, which I'll tell you about now retroactively. So if you... Good. People that listen know.
If you want to skip back to a particular part.
Don't worry, Anthony. This episode is going to have a very abrasive and hard to get past intro anyway. So we're already going to be weeding out all the newbies with the intro.
Spoiler.
They've already heard it by this point.
I haven't.
Hey, you don't listen to most of them anyway, right?
As soon as somebody in the Discord is like, wow, great intro this week, then I'm like, oh, I should go listen to that.
Okay, I'm glad that at least that caused you to listen to it. If you saw that and then we were still like, nah, I don't need to, that would be a bummer.
No, I try to. I forget sometimes.
All right. We're done here. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This podcast is produced by thinking really hard about magic cards and then speaking into microphones about it. Always speak your truth, Anthony. I never want this show to become something we're doing because we think it's what we're supposed to do instead of what we really truly feel in our heart of hearts.
The truth is, I should really stop looking at this cactus guy because I have... two books on my to read list that I know are going to involve cactus folk, and I just...
You're worried you're going to taint your cactus folk?
I've spoiled the image in my mind looking at these cactus folks.
That's rough. That's hard.
It's a shame.